Kim Purcell is an award-winning real estate sales representative working under the Sutton Group Masters Realty Brokerage. Kim was born and raised in Kingston and is into her ninth year of real estate. She has intimate knowledge of the area, which has positively influenced her career as a realtor and led to numerous five-star reviews from clients. If you're looking for a real estate agent in the Kingston area who is trustworthy and will work for your best interests, you're in good hands with Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca to learn more about Kim's realty services and listings today.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
And the Oscar goes to No Other Land.
No Other Land reflect the harsh reality that we have been enduring for decades and still resist as we call on the world to take serious actions to stop the injustice.
There is a different path, a political solution without ethnic supremacy, with national rights for both of our people. And I have to say, as I am here, the foreign policy in this country is helping to block this path.
No Other Land wins Best Documentary at the Oscars. We'll hear the full acceptance speeches of the Palestinian and Israeli journalists who made the film. Then European leaders hold an emergency summit after an unprecedented public clash in the Oval Office between Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and both President Donald Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance.
You have nice ocean and don't feel now, but you will feel it in the future. God bless. You will not have war.
Don't tell us what we're going to feel. We're trying to solve a problem. Don't tell us what we're going to feel.
We'll look at the prospects for peace in Ukraine with longtime human rights advocate Ken Roth.
Key to getting past the disastrous Trump-Zelensky meeting is to ensure that Trump doesn't have just a temporary ceasefire that lets Putin rearm and reinvade, but push him to make a good deal where the U.S. provides a backstop to European security guarantees that preserve Ukraine's democracy.
Kenneth Roth served almost 30 years as executive director of Human Rights Watch. We'll talk with him about Ukraine, Gaza, and his new book, Righting Wrongs, Three Decades on the Front Lines Battling Abuse of Governments. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Leaders in Europe held an emergency summit in London Sunday, 2 days after an unprecedented clash at the White House between Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and both President Donald Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance. Zelensky had traveled to the White House to sign a deal giving the United States partial control over Ukraine's raw earth minerals. But the deal imploded following a dramatic televised Oval Office meeting where Trump accused Zelensky of gambling with World War III after Zelensky insisted Ukraine could only back a Russia peace deal if it included security guarantees from the United States. The news conference ended with Trump and J.D. Vance openly criticizing Zelensky.
You're not in a good position.
You don't have the cards right now.
With us, you start having
cards.
Right now, you don't.
You're playing cards, Mr. President.
You're gambling with the lives of millions of people.
You're
gambling with World War III.
You're gambling with World War III.
And what you're doing is very disrespectful to the country, this country.
With all respect to you, far more than a lot of people said they should have.
Have you said thank you once?
A lot of times.
No, in this
even
entire
today,
meeting, you said thank
even
you.
Even today.
You went to Pennsylvania and campaigned for the opposition in October. Oh. Offer some words of appreciation for the United States of America and the president who's trying to save your country.
Shortly after this exchange, Secretary of State Marco Rubio and National Security Advisor Mike Waltz asked Zelensky to leave the White House. Trump's treatment of Zelensky shocked many in Washington and around the world. Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski said, quote, I'm sick to my stomach as the administration appears to be walking away from our allies and embracing Putin, a threat to democracy and U.S. values around the world, unquote. Meanwhile, House Speaker Mike Johnson suggested Zelensky may need to step down following the White House meeting. After leaving Washington, Zelensky traveled to London to meet on Saturday with British Prime Minister Keir Starmer, who warmly greeted Zelensky outside 10 Downing Street. On Sunday, Starmer hosted an emergency meeting of European leaders. He called for a coalition of the willing to be formed to support Ukraine if a peace deal is reached.
We will go further to develop a coalition of the willing to defend a deal in Ukraine and to guarantee the peace. The UK is prepared to back this with boots on the ground and planes in the air, together with others. Europe must do the heavy lifting. But to support peace in our continent and to succeed, this effort must have strong US backing.
Meanwhile, France is pushing for a one-month truce between Russia and Ukraine. While almost all of Europe is backing Ukraine, Hungary's authoritarian leader Viktor Orban praised Trump, saying, quote, strong men make peace, weak men make war. President Trump stood bravely for peace, even if it was difficult for many to digest, Orban said. In other fallout from the White House meeting, a major Norwegian fuel supplier, Haltbach Bunkers, has announced it's halting fuel sales to U.S. ships. The company said, quote, today we witness the biggest disgrace ever put on display by the current U.S. president and his vice president, unquote. In other news on U.S.-Russian relations, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has ordered U.S. Cyber Command to suspend offensive cyber operations targeting Russia. The Pentagon has not publicly discussed the policy change, but National Security Advisor Mike Waltz told CNN the United States would use, quote, all kinds of carrots and sticks to get this war to an end, unquote. Meanwhile, on Sunday, Russian state television aired an interview with Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov talking about Trump. He said, quote, the new administration is rapidly changing all foreign policy configurations. This largely aligns with our vision, unquote. On Friday, a member of Russia's state-owned news agency, TASS, gained access to the Oval Office during the clash between Zelensky and President Trump, while reporters from the Associated Press and Reuters were excluded. The White House said the Russian reporter was not approved and was eventually removed. The United Nations and many Arab nations have condemned Israel for cutting off all food and humanitarian aid into Gaza. Egypt and Qatar accused Israel of using starvation as a weapon of war. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced the blockade as Israel attempts to pressure Hamas to agree to a new proposal by the United States that would force Hamas to release all remaining hostages without Israel fully withdrawing from Gaza. Hamas has accused Israel of trying to derail the original ceasefire agreement. Over the past 2 days, Israeli troops have killed at least 9 Palestinians in Gaza. Residents in Gaza denounce the new Israeli blockade.
Suffering will increase after the occupation's decision to close the crossings. Frankly, since the beginning of the war, they have been trying to starve us, and we fear the people will starve due to the lack of aid and food supplies. Additionally, people are afraid of the return of war and facing death again. Isn't it enough that the occupation has killed 50 or 60,000 murderers so far?
The Trump administration is fast-tracking another $4 billion in weapons to Israel, including more than 35,000 2,000-pound bombs, as well as 4,000 Predator warheads. Secretary of State Marco Rubio signed an emergency declaration that bypasses Congress to expedite the arms shipment. The Trump administration has approved $12 billion in arms for Israel over the past 5 weeks. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is urging the Trump administration to reverse its sweeping cuts to international humanitarian programs, saying it'll make the world less healthy, less safe, and less prosperous.
The consequences will be especially devastating for vulnerable people around the world.
South Africa is one nation that could be particularly hard hit by Trump's foreign aid cuts. An official at the Desmond Tutu HIV Center is warning the funding cuts to HIV projects could lead to 500,000 deaths in South Africa over the next 10 years. Meanwhile, an advisor to the Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation said Trump's halt to foreign aid amounts to a, quote, death sentence for mothers and children, unquote. In related news, a high-ranking official at USAID has been placed on leave after warning in a memo that the administration has failed to protect programs that deliver life-saving assistance despite a promise of waivers by Secretary of State Marco Rubio. Nick Enrich, USAID's acting assistant administrator for global health, had written a memo, quote, "This will no doubt result in preventable death, destabilization, and threats to national security on a massive scale," unquote. In other Trump news, federal judge Amy Berman Jackson has ruled the head of a key government watchdog was illegally fired. The ruling centered on Trump's firing of Hampton Dellinger, the head of the Office of Special Counsel, which handles whistleblower complaints. In her ruling, Judge Berman Jackson warned against giving Trump a, quote, constitutional license to bully officials in the executive branch into doing his will, unquote. In other legal news, the Democratic National Committee and related groups have sued Trump over his attempt to strip the bipartisan Federal Election Commission of its independence. In immigration news, the Washington Post is reporting the Department of Homeland Security has asked the IRS to hand over detailed information on about 700,000 suspected undocumented immigrants, including their home addresses, phone numbers, and email addresses. According to the Washington Post, the Internal Revenue Service initially refused the request, but the agency's new acting commissioner is reportedly exploring how to comply. Federal law bars the IRS from sharing personal tax information with other government agencies. Meanwhile, President Trump has signed an executive order designating English as the official language of the United States. The move comes weeks after the White House took down the Spanish language version of the official White House website. In Illinois, a jury found landlord Joseph Zuba guilty of murder and hate crimes for killing 6-year-old Palestinian-American child Wadi Al-Fayoumi and wounding his mother, Hanan Shaheen, in October of 2023 in the town of Plainfield. He now faces life in prison without parole. After the verdict was announced, Wadi Al-Fayoumi's father, Ode Al-Fayoumi, spoke at a news conference, his words translated by CARE Chicago's executive director, Ahmed Rehab.
"For me as a father, I feel like I'm discovering Wadiya and learning about Wadiya more every day. And suffice for me as a father to know that his pride in being who he was as a Palestinian, as a Muslim, as an Arab, and being killed and targeted for that was sufficient for him to live through, even though it caused his death. And that for me, I will always remember him with pride."
Here in New York, former Governor Andrew Cuomo has announced he's running for New York City mayor. This comes 3 years after Cuomo was forced to resign as governor in the wake of 11 accusations of sexual misconduct. Cuomo was also found by a New York ethics board to have improperly used state funds to write his coronavirus pandemic memoir and has been accused of deliberately underreporting and covering up the number of nursing home deaths during the pandemic. Cuomo joins a crowded field ahead of the Democratic primary June 24th as calls grow for New York City Mayor Eric Adams to resign. Adams has been widely accused of accepting a quid pro quo from the White House to enact Trump's immigration crackdown in exchange for the Justice Department pushing for Adams' corruption charges to be dropped. In other news from New York, another prisoner has died. An unnamed 22-year-old at the Mid-State Correctional Facility near Utica was pronounced dead on Saturday. 9 fellow prisoners said the deceased was brutally beaten by prison officers. This comes 2 days after a prison guard union reached a tentative deal with New York Governor Kathy Hochul to end a wildcat strike that started 2 weeks ago. The deal suspended parts of the HALT Act, which limits the use of solitary confinement. 2 other prisoners died during the strike. Iowa's Republican Governor Kim Reynolds signed into law a bill ending civil rights protections based on gender identity, becoming the first state to repeal civil rights protections for transgender people. Last week, protesters flooded the Iowa Capitol in Des Moines to defend trans rights as lawmakers voted to curtail them. Protesters lined the streets of Waitsfield, Vermont, as Vice President J.D. Vance arrived for a ski vacation at the Sugarbush Resort this weekend. Protesters held signs expressing anger at the Trump-Vance administration over everything from its attacks on trans rights, the climate, and Palestinian rights, as well as the pair's treatment of Ukrainian President Zelensky and its mass firing of federal workers. Vance and his family reportedly had to move their stay to an undisclosed location because of the demonstrations. Several protests were also held at Sugarbush Resort. Protests targeting Elon Musk also took place over the weekend. In New York, 9 people were arrested as they demonstrated outside a Tesla dealership. Rallies also took place in front of Tesla retailers in Jacksonville, Florida, Tucson, Arizona, and other cities as protesters held signs reading messages like "No dictators in the USA." In Los Angeles, hundreds demonstrated at the SpaceX facility in Hawthorne. SpaceX has received billions of dollars in government funding and has been apparently trying to take over a $2.4 billion Federal Aviation Administration contract that had already been awarded to Verizon. Meanwhile, thousands gathered at national parks across the country to condemn the firings of at least 1,000 National Park Service workers and to defend public lands. In New York City, hundreds gathered outside the United Nations headquarters Saturday, demanding the Trump administration cancel next week's huge military drills known as Freedom Shield on the Korean Peninsula.
My name's Neon. I'm with Norodol for Korean Community Development. And I'm here today alongside thousands of Koreans and their allies in the U.S. to declare an end to the U.S.-led Freedom Shield war exercises and to demand an end of U.S. taxpayer dollars to fund endless war in Korea. The Korean War has not ended. We're still at a ceasefire, just like in Palestine, except for Korean history has told us 75 years later, the U.S. is still in our homeland. It's still dividing Korea. So we need to demand a complete end to ceaseless war provocations and war games.
South Korea is the site of Camp Humphreys, the world's largest overseas U.S. military installation. And the Oscars were held Sunday evening. History was made in the Best Documentary category.
And the Oscar goes to No Other Land.
The Palestinian-Israeli film No Other Land won for Best Documentary. The film follows the struggles of Palestinians in the occupied West Bank community of Masafer Yatta to stay on their land amidst violent attacks by Israeli settlers aimed at expelling them. The film was made by a team of Palestinian-Israeli filmmakers, including the Palestinian journalist Basil Adra, who lives in Masafer Yatta, and the Israeli journalist Yuval Abraham. They both spoke at the ceremony, beginning with Basil Adra, who became the first Palestinian filmmaker to win an Oscar.
Thank you to the Academy for the award. It's such a big honor for the four of us and everybody supported us for this documentary. About 2 months ago, I became a father and my hope to my daughter that she will not have to live the same life I'm living now, always fearing settlers' violence, home demolitions, and forest-built displacements that my community, Masafer Yatta, is living and facing every day under the Israeli occupation. No other land reflect the harsh reality that we have been enduring for decades and still persist as we call on the world to take serious actions to stop the injustice and to stop the ethnic cleansing of Palestinian people.
We made this film, Palestinians and Israelis, because together our voices are stronger. We see each other. The atrocious destruction of Gaza and its people, which must end. The Israeli hostages brutally taken in the crime of October 7th, which must be freed. When I look at Basil, I see my brother, but we are unequal. We live in a regime where I am free. under civilian law and Bassel is under military laws that destroy his life and he cannot control. There is a different path, a political solution without ethnic supremacy, with national rights for both of our people. And I have to say, as I am here, the foreign policy in this country is helping to block this path. And, you know, why? Can't you see that we are intertwined? That my people can be truly safe if Bassel's people are truly free and safe? There is another way. It's not too late for life, for the living. There is no other way. Thank you.
Israeli filmmaker Yuval Abraham and Palestinian filmmaker Bazel Adra, co-directors of No Other Land, which just won the Oscar for Best Documentary. Visit democracynow.org to see our interviews with both of them. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we play an extended excerpt of the unprecedented public clash in the Oval Office between Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and both President Trump and Vice President Vance. Then we spend the hour with Ken Roth, former head of Human Rights Watch, about Ukraine, Gaza, and his new book, Righting Wrongs, 3 decades on the front lines battling abusive governments. Stay with us. Get What You Want by the Rolling Stones. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer says Europe is at crossroads in history as leaders across Europe held an emergency summit in London Sunday, 2 days after an unprecedented Oval Office public clash in the White House between Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and both President Trump and Vice President Vance. After the disastrous meeting, Vice President Vance was met by hundreds of protesters in Waitsfield, Vermont, where he went for a family ski trip. And emergency rallies for a fair peace in Ukraine were held in New York and Los Angeles. Zelensky had traveled to the White House to sign a deal giving the United States partial control over Ukraine's raw earth minerals. But the deal imploded following this dramatic televised press conference where President Trump accused Zelensky of gambling with World War III after Zelensky insisted Ukraine could only back a Russia peace deal if it included security guarantees from the United States. The meeting ended with Trump and Vance openly criticizing Zelensky. We begin today's show with an extended portion of the clash.
For 4 years in the United States of America, we had a president who stood up at press conferences and talked tough about Vladimir Putin, and then Putin invaded Ukraine and destroyed a significant chunk of the country. The path to peace and the path to prosperity is maybe engaging in diplomacy. We tried the pathway of Joe Biden, of thumping our chest and pretending that the President of the United States' words mattered more than the President of the United States' actions. What makes America a good country is America engaging in diplomacy. That's what President Trump is doing.
Can I ask you?
Sure.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. So he occupied it, our parts, big parts of Ukraine, parts of East and Crimea. So he occupied it on 2014. So during a lot of years, I'm not speaking about just Biden, but those time was Obama, then President Obama, then President Trump, then President Biden, now President Trump, and God bless, now President Trump will stop him. But during 2014, nobody stopped him. He just occupied and took. He killed people. You know what the contact
2015. Line?
2014.
Yeah, yeah. So I was not here.
Yeah, but
that's exactly
but,
right.
Yes,
yeah.
But during 2014 till 2022, yeah, the situation the same. The people have been dying on the contact line. Nobody stopped him. You know that we had conversations with him, a lot of conversations, my bilateral conversation, and we signed with him, me, like a new president in 2019. I signed with him the deal. I signed with him, Macron and Merkel, we signed ceasefire. Ceasefire, all of them told me that he will never go. We signed him gas contract. Gas contract. Yes, but after that, he broken this ceasefire. He killed our people and he didn't exchange prisoners. We signed the exchange of prisoners, but he didn't do it. What kind of diplomacy? JD, you are speaking about what do you mean?
I'm talking about the kind of diplomacy that's going to end the destruction of your country.
Yes, but if you
Mr.
are not strong,
Mr. President, with respect, I think it's disrespectful for you to come into the Oval Office and try to litigate this in front of the American media. Right now, you guys are going around and forcing conscripts to the front lines because you have manpower problems. You should be thanking the president for trying to bring it into this conflict.
Have you ever been to Ukraine that you say what problems we have?
I have been to.
Come once.
I've actually watched and seen the stories, and I know what happens is you bring people, you bring them on a propaganda tour, Mr. President. Do you disagree that you've had problems bringing people into your military?
Do we have problems?
And do you think that it's respectful to come to the Oval Office of the United States of America and attack the administration that is trying to prevent the destruction of your country?
A lot of questions. Let's start from the beginning.
Sure.
First of all, during the war, everybody has problems, even you, but you have nice ocean and don't feel now, but you will feel it in the future. God bless you, you will not have war.
Don't tell us what we're going to feel. We're trying to solve a problem. Don't tell us what we're going to feel.
I'm not telling you.
Because
I'm
you're in no position to dictate that.
That's
remember
exactly
this.
I'm not dictating.
You're in no position to dictate what we're going to feel. We're going to feel very good and very strong.
You will feel influence.
You're right now not in a very good position. You've allowed yourself to be in a very bad position, and he happens to be right about it.
From the very beginning of the war,
you're not in a good position. You don't have the cards right now. With us, you start having
cards.
Right now, you don't. Yeah, you're playing cards,
Mr. President.
You're playing cards. You're gambling with the lives of millions of people. You're gambling with World War III. You're gambling with World War III. And what you're doing is very disrespectful to the country, this country.
I'm
that's
with
back
all
to
respect
you,
to you.
Far country. More than a lot of people said they
respect.
Should have.
Have you said thank you once?
A lot of times.
No, in this
even
entire
today,
meeting, you said thank
even
you.
Even today.
You went to Pennsylvania and campaigned for the opposition in October. Oh. Offer some words of appreciation for the United States of America and the president who's trying to save your country.
Please, you think that... If you will speak very loudly about the war,
he's not speaking loudly. He's not speaking loudly. Your country is in big trouble.
Can I answer?
No, no. You've done a lot of talking. Your country is in big trouble.
I know.
You're not winning. I know. You're not winning this. You have a damn good chance of coming out okay because of us.
Mr. President, we are staying in our country, staying strong from the very beginning of the war. We've been alone, and we are thankful. I said thanks
in
this cabinet, and not only in this cabinet.
We gave you, through this stupid president, $350 billion.
You voted for your
president. We gave you military equipment, and
your
men are brave, but they had to use our military.
What about West?
If you didn't have our military equipment, if you didn't have our military equipment, this war would have been over in 2 weeks.
In three days, I heard it from Putin. In 3 days. This is something
maybe
new.
Less.
In 2 weeks. Of course, yes.
It's going to be a very hard thing to do business like this,
again,
I tell you.
Just say thank you.
Said a lot of times thank you to American people.
Except that there are disagreements, and let's go litigate those disagreements rather than trying to fight it out in the American media when you're wrong. We know that you're wrong.
But you see, I think it's good for the American people to see what's going on here. I think it's very important. That's why I kept this going so long. You have to be thankful. You don't have the cards.
I'm thankful.
You're buried there. Your people are dying.
I can tell you
you're
again,
running low on soldiers.
Don't,
listen.
Don't, please,
you're running
Mr.
low
Brad.
On soldiers. It would be a damn good
Mr.
thing. And
Brad.
then you tell us, I don't want a ceasefire. I don't want a ceasefire. I want to go, and I want this. Look, if you could get a ceasefire right now, I tell you, you take it so the bullets stop flying and your men stop getting killed.
Of course we want to stop the war. But
you're saying you don't want a ceasefire.
But I said to you,
I want a ceasefire.
With guarantees.
Because you'll get a ceasefire faster than an agreement.
Ask our people about ceasefire, what they think.
That wasn't with me.
It doesn't matter for you what
that wasn't with me.
It
that was with a guy named Biden who was not a smart person.
But this
that
was is your, with, this that was is with your Obama. President. It was your president.
Excuse me. That was with Obama who gave you sheets and I gave you javelins.
Yes.
I gave you the javelins to take out all those tanks. Obama gave you sheets. In fact, the statement is Obama gave sheets and Trump gave javelins. You got to be more thankful because let me tell you, you don't have the cards. With us, you have the cards. But without us, you don't have any cards. All I can say is this. He might have broken deals with Obama and Bush, and he might have broken them with Biden. He did, maybe. Maybe he didn't. I don't know what happened. But he didn't break them with me. He wants to make a deal. I don't know if you can make a deal. The problem is, I've empowered you to be a tough guy. And I don't think you'd be a tough guy without the United States. And your people are very brave. But you're either going to make a deal or we're out. And if we're out, you'll fight it out. I don't think it's going to be pretty, but you'll fight it out. But you don't have the cards. But once we sign that deal, you're in a much better position. But you're not acting at all thankful. And that's not a nice thing. I'll be honest, that's not a nice thing.
An extended excerpt of Friday's public clash with news reporters looking on, a White House meeting in the Oval Office between Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and both President Donald Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance. AP and Reuters were excluded from the press pool while a reporter with Russia's state-owned news agency TASS was there. The White House later said they didn't know how he'd been allowed in, that he was removed as soon as they were notified of his presence. Shortly after this exchange, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, National Security Advisor Mike Waltz asked Zelensky to leave the White House without signing any deal. Trump's treatment of Zelensky shocked many in Washington and around the world. Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski said, quote, I'm sick to my stomach as the administration appears to be walking away from our allies and embracing Putin, a threat to democracy and U.S. values around the world. Meanwhile, House Speaker Mike Johnson suggested President Zelensky may need to step down following the White House clash. Meanwhile, leaders in Europe held an emergency summit in London Sunday, where British Prime Minister Keir Starmer, who warmly greeted Zelensky outside 10 Downing Street and called for a coalition of the willing to be formed to support Ukraine if a peace deal is reached. For more, we're joined here in New York by Kenneth Roth, visiting professor at the Prince School of Public and International Affairs, served for nearly 30 years as the executive director of Human Rights Watch. His new book is just out. It's titled Righting Wrongs, Three Decades on the Front Lines Battling Abusive Governments. His recent piece for The Guardian headlined, Even Trump can be cajoled into doing the right thing. You just have to know which buttons to press. Ken Roth, welcome back to Democracy Now! Thanks so much for joining us. First, your response to this public clash.
Well, Amy, it's great to be back. I think it's important to note that the segment you just showed was preceded by 40 minutes of normal, reasonable conversation. And as this, weird press conference, because it was supposed to be, a heads of state meeting, but it was all televised, as it was drawing to an end, that's when J.D. Vance stepped in and tried to sabotage things. And, who knows what he was thinking. Partly it was, speaking to the media, remember me, I'm the guy who you ignore when you focus on Elon Musk. Partly it was his longstanding hostility to Ukraine's democracy. He favors Putin, he favors the neo-Nazi German AFD party. But when he started clashing with Zelensky, Zelensky said, well, what do you mean just diplomacy? What do you mean we don't need security guarantees? We have this long history of Putin violating various ceasefire guarantees and basically using the pause to rearm and reinvade. And that's what everybody fears now. And Vance had no answer to that. So he got into attack dog mode. Why aren't you more thankful? And that, it's embarrassing, frankly, as an American to see the two leading American officials behaving so in such a juvenile fashion when these are life and death matters for not only Ukrainian people, but for Ukrainian democracy and potentially European democracy. But this is how policy is being made. And you know, I think the real challenge now is, you know, can this be salvaged? What is on the table is, you know, not just a temporary ceasefire deal, but will the United States provide aerial backup for the European peacekeeping force that would be put on the ground to prevent Putin from reinvading down the road? It's a very reasonable request. Trump has refused to agree to that. You know, he just, you know, it's on the table repeatedly, and he doesn't say yes. That's what Zelensky was trying to secure, and that's what Vance and then ultimately Trump sabotaged.
Now, of course, Trump also has long-term resentments of President Zelensky. That's why he was bringing up Hunter Biden's laptop, etc., involving his first impeachment.
No, precisely. I mean, he was impeached because of Trump's utterly improper effort to persuade Zelensky to investigate Hunter Biden when Trump was facing a potential challenge from Biden. So this, you know, this is how American foreign policy is being made. And, you know, understandably, the world is appalled. And I think the real question is, you know, how do we salvage the situation? And as I wrote in that Guardian piece that you just mentioned, I do think that there's a way of salvaging disaster from all of this. And that is to really look at what Trump cares about, which is that, and he said this repeatedly during this press conference, you know, he is a master deal maker. He spent his entire life making deals. And if we can show that, you know, a deal that is just a ceasefire without security guarantees will be a bad deal, it'll be just a matter of time before Putin then tries to reinvade and take Kyiv, Trump has the potential of having a legacy of as being the Neville Chamberlain of the 21st century, you know, a man who appeased Putin and made a horrible deal. And I don't think he wants to be remembered for that. So I think that that's our best route forward, is to stress that, you know, much as Trump dislikes Zelensky, much as Trump doesn't want to, you know, get the U.S. military involved anyplace, this is a matter where the U.S. is being asked to take a pretty minimalist stance. And Trump's refusal will utterly blow up this deal that he wants to make.
So we'll see what happens, because Zelensky went from not signing the deal because Trump took it off the table of rare earth minerals, and we'll talk about that in a minute, to London, where an emergency meeting was called of European leaders. There's even some discussion of possibly Macron, Starmer, and Zelensky coming back to the White House at some point. I want to go to British Prime Minister Keir Starmer speaking Sunday after the meeting with European lenders to discuss a peace proposal that would end Russia's war in Ukraine.
We will go further to develop a coalition of the willing to defend a deal in Ukraine and to guarantee the peace. The UK is prepared to back this with boots on the ground and planes in the air, together with others. Europe must do the heavy lifting. But to support peace in our continent and to succeed, this effort must have strong U.S. backing.
He's standing at a podium that says securing our future. He talks about a coalition of the willing, which ominously harkens back to the Iraq War, which you write about in Righting Wrongs, which was the U.S. forcing a number of countries to support its war on Iraq, interestingly.
Yeah. Well, look, the coalition of the willing is all that they can do. If they do a European Union force, they're subject to Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban's veto. So that's just not an option, because Orban is in there as a pawn for Putin. But Starmer is absolutely right. Putting European peacekeepers on the ground won't be enough, because Putin will attack them. And they feel that they need a U.S. backstop. Now, you know, Trump's answer was, well, what do you mean we're going to have this mineral deal and we'll have American miners on the ground? What more do you need? That's your security guarantee. And this, you know, utterly ignores what Putin wants, because he could care less about, you know, more minerals or a little bit more territory. He wants to snuff out Ukraine's democracy, because this represents a danger for Putin. You know, this is a major Slavic country right on the border of Russia, many Russian speakers. It represents the democracy that Russians don't have, and that's why he wants to get rid of it.
But it could be that this U.S. rare earth minerals deal is more of a threat to Putin than Zelensky. The U.S. really being interested there in because of iPhones, because of Tesla cars, batteries, etc. That the U.S. controlling this part of Ukraine would be a real threat to Putin.
You know, I don't think that's what matters so much. In other words, you know, Putin already is saying, we'll give you some of the rare earths from the occupied part of Ukraine, where Russia's in control. You know, I mean, minerals can be sold by whoever owns them. What this fight is really about is, does Ukraine maintain its democracy or not? And that's what Putin wants to snuff out. And without these U.S.-backed European security guarantees, he's going to succeed. And that's why this fight in the White House, you know, was not just this juvenile food fight that Vance and Trump turned it into. This was really a life and death matter for Ukraine's democracy.
The fact that we've never seen something like this in the White House, you had also so-called, you know, anchors and press people weighing in, like One American News, the partner of Congressmember Marjorie Taylor Greene, asking Zelensky why he wasn't wearing a suit. And he said, this is wartime. I don't do it at that time. But maybe he calls them costumes. Zelensky calls them, I'll be wearing a costume when the war ends. That's nicer than yours. But I mean, the low level of this discussion. And then interestingly, Reuters and AP not being allowed in. AP, we know, because they refused to say Gulf of America. They continue to refer to Gulf of Mexico. But TASS somehow inexplicably getting in. That's the Russian state news agency. And when the White House was told, they said, we don't know how he got into the inner sanctum of a man who's attempted assassination twice against Trump. We'll take him out.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, nobody gets into the inner sanctums of the White House without being let in very deliberately. So, you know, this is just not credible. They don't know how he got there. The fact that the One America guy is let in and, you know, legitimate, serious journalists are not just shows how Trump is not only surrounding himself by sycophants among his close advisors, but also wants only sycophantic journalists. And, you know, for Zelensky to say, look, I'm wearing kind of military-like garb because my country was invaded and I'm at war, and as a matter of solidarity with the soldiers, I'm going to dress like this until the war is over with. And to have a journalist who mocks him is just absurd. That shows, you know, just the triviality of the people surrounding Trump.
Finally, do you think there's a chance of peace soon?
I do think that everybody wants some kind of deal. I mean, at this point, you know, thousands upon thousands of soldiers are being killed for tiny little slivers of territory. You know, Putin treats Russian soldiers, as well as now North Koreans, as just cannon fodder. You know, it's awful, and there's no point in this continuing. It really does come down to, is Putin going to just stop temporarily and then reinvade, or will security guarantees be put in place to prevent that? I think everybody but Trump wants that, and the question is, how do we persuade Trump to take that next step?
Kenneth Roth is visiting professor at Princeton School of Public and International Affairs. He has a new book out. It's called Righting Wrongs: Three Decades on the Front Lines Battling Abusive Governments. When we come back, we talk about Gaza and more. Stay with us. The Four Seasons by People Looking for Songs. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations, as well as many Arab nations, have condemned Israel for cutting off all food and humanitarian aid into Gaza. Egypt and Qatar accused Israel of using starvation as a weapon of war. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced the blockade in an attempt to pressure Hamas to agree to a new proposal by the United States that would force Hamas to release all remaining hostages without Israeli soldiers fully withdrawing from Gaza. Hamas has accused Israel of trying to derail the original ceasefire agreement. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke Sunday.
Hamas currently controls all of the supplies and goods that are being sent to the Gaza Strip. It is abusing the Gaza population that is trying to receive the aid. It is shooting at them and is turning the humanitarian aid into a budget for terrorism directed against us. To this, we will not agree in any way.
Over the past 2 days, Israeli troops have killed at least 9 Palestinians in Gaza. Palestinians there have denounced the new Israeli blockade.
Suffering will increase after the occupation's decision to close the crossings. Frankly, since the beginning of the war, they have been trying to starve us, and we fear the people will starve due to the lack of aid and food supplies. Additionally, people are afraid of the return of war and facing death again. Isn't it enough that the occupation has killed 50 or 60,000 murderers so far?
We continue our conversation with Ken Roth, visiting professor at Princeton School of Public and International Affairs, served for almost 30 years as executive director of Human Rights Watch. He has a new book out. It's called Righting Wrongs, 3 decades on the Front Lines Battling Abusive Governments. So Israel has just blocked all humanitarian aid from going into Gaza. Your response?
Well, first, this is a continuation of the starvation strategy that Israel has been pursuing against Palestinian civilians in Gaza, which is a war crime, which was the reason that Netanyahu and the former defense minister Gallant were charged by the International Criminal Court with war crimes. Second, the fact that Israel is turning on and off the spigot is actually evidence of the deliberateness of the starvation strategy, because during the war, Israel kept saying, oh, what do you mean we're letting in the food? It's just, you know, it's Hamas's fault. When it's absolutely clear that Israel just shuts the door sometimes, even when, you know, during the bulk of the war, Palestinians were facing, you know, near famine and certainly starvation. So, you know, this is in a sense further evidence against Netanyahu. Now, you know, what he's trying to do, as you just alluded to, is change the terms of the ceasefire negotiations, because the temporary ceasefire, the initial 6 weeks, have now come to an end. And stage two was supposed to be Israeli forces fully pulling out of Gaza, an end to the war, and then further exchanges of hostages and Israeli-Palestinian, you know, Palestinians who were held as prisoners by Israel. And Netanyahu's saying, no, just give us the hostages, but we're not going to do the other part. And we're going to starve you until you agree. So that's the context in which this is happening.
You know, it's interesting. We just spent our last segment talking about Ukraine and President Trump trying to pressure Zelensky, basically saying you would be no one if it weren't for the United States giving you weapons. What about his very dear ally and close friend, Netanyahu? The amount of what these 2,000-pound bombs mean, what the amount from Biden through Trump, the military arming of Israel to facilitate what's happening in Gaza and the West Bank?
Well, I think we have to understand that the U.S. was aiding and abetting massive war crimes, indeed arguably genocide. And Biden continued the arms sales, continued the military aid, despite abundant evidence that these war crimes were taking place. The one thing Biden did that was good is that he withheld the 2,000-pound bombs. He suspended their delivery because these were being used to devastate Palestinian communities in Gaza. A 2,000-pound bomb can basically kill anybody within the radius of 2 football fields. These are utterly inappropriate to be used in the heavily populated areas. This is indiscriminate warfare, a war crime. And Trump just renewed them. Here, take them, do whatever you want. So if the fighting resumes, Trump also could be accused of aiding and abetting war crimes. I think, though, the real risk for Trump is that he has now imposed sanctions on the International Criminal Court prosecutor, Karim Khan. And that is a blatant violation of Article 70 of the Rome Statute, the ICC's guiding treaty, which criminalizes obstruction of justice, intimidating or threatening a court official for their official duties. And, you know, will Karim Khan charge Trump? I don't know. He didn't do that. The prior prosecutor didn't do that when Trump imposed sanctions on her. But, you know, Karim Khan's a different guy. And if Trump continues to played this incredibly obstructive role, it wouldn't surprise me if he suddenly faces criminal charges too. And people can say, well, who would arrest Trump? But what it would mean is that the 125 member states of the ICC suddenly would be obliged to arrest him if he showed up. So they would tell him, don't show up. And his world would suddenly be a lot smaller, similar to what Putin now faces when, you know, for example, he couldn't go to the BRICS summit in South Africa for fear of arrest.
So you have a chapter in your book, Righting Wrongs, Three Decades on the Frontlines Battling Abusive Governments on War Crimes. Can you talk about what has happened to the whole issue of international law? You're fiercely critical. You were of Biden and now of President Trump. When, as we look right now, you're looking at Israel, Gaza, and the West Bank. The complete shutting down or disregard for international criminal law, whether we're talking about the International Court of Justice or the International Criminal Court or human rights law since World War II and why it was established.
Well, first of all, I think it's important to stress that international humanitarian law or the laws of war, it was not written by human rights groups as this kind of pie-in-the-sky standard. This was written by the world's militaries. They decided that this is the best way to fight war, to try to spare civilians, not to replicate the mass atrocities of the Second World War. So Human Rights Watch and our allies tries to uphold that law. Clearly, it is flouted by Israel, you know, by the Sudanese fighters, by Putin in Ukraine, by the Myanmar junta. So there are, you know, examples of systematic war crimes. But most governments still formally uphold these standards. Their militaries abide by them. And this is where something like the International Criminal Court is very important because, you know, yes, you always have crimes. But to have a court come in and say, you know, you're going to be prosecuted for these crimes helps to resurrect the standards. So this is a battle. And that's one of the things I really stress in the book, that, you know, the defense of human rights requires persistent pressure. Governments are always tempted to violate human rights. And our job in the human rights community is to push back, you know, to change the cost-benefit calculus of repression. And, you know, sometimes you win, sometimes you lose, but there are repeated cases in the book where we win, where the pressure worked.
You know, there's an amazing moment now. The Office of Government Efficiency, if you're really looking at huge sums of money, Guantanamo, what, 15 men are being held there, many of them without charge, and it's cost $500 million to keep it open on this extrajudicial area that the U.S. controls in Cuba. And now, in order to keep it open, they're talking about sending migrants there, immigrants who've come into this country.
Yeah. I mean, I go into Guantanamo at length in the book. And in many ways, I view that as a success of the human rights movement, because we really did stop the Bush-era torture. We got legislation that adopted that shut down the various loopholes that Bush was using. Guantanamo gradually has been depopulated. No one has been added to it in a criminal sense. You know, these migrants who are being put there are being put in a different part of the island and are not really changing the extreme cost.
The tens of thousands of them could be put there if the Trump administration has their way.
Yeah, and I don't think the courts are going to allow it, because I think there really are legislative obstacles to, you know, taking immigrants in the United States and just putting them in this extraterritorial area. So, but, you know, I think that the fact that Guantanamo was so stigmatized, that this idea of endless detention without trial for so-called enemy combatants was a legal theory that, you know, just didn't hold, was in an odd way a success of the human rights movement. And even though we haven't completely shut it down, we made huge progress in making it, you know, unusable for criminal purposes.
I wanted to go back to Gaza and then to your own life experience, your family. There was a history made last night. You had a Palestinian filmmaker and an Israeli filmmaker winning the best documentary category. It's the first time a Palestinian has won. After Bezalel Adra spoke, Yuval Abraham, the Israeli journalist, spoke. He said, well, this is the end of what Yuval Abraham said. They're saying something like 1 billion people watched. This is his message.
There is a different path, a political solution without ethnic supremacy, with national rights for both of our people. And I have to say, as I am here, the foreign policy in this country is helping to block this path. And, you know, why? Can't you see that we are intertwined? that my people can be truly safe. If Basel's people are truly free and safe, there is another way. It's not too late for life, for the living. There is no other way. Thank you.
As they held their Oscars, Yuval Abraham and Basil Adra, this incredible moment, and you hear the applause. I mean, the change of public opinion in the United States. There's a global audience, but we heard the audience in that room. If you can talk about the power of the U.S. And also your own life experience, where you come from. You are, we'll talk about your life and your parents.
Okay, well, Amy, I really got into the defense of human rights because of the experience of my father. He grew up in Nazi Germany and fled Frankfurt as a 12-year-old boy in July 1938 for New York. And so I grew up with Hitler stories. You know, I grew up with what it was like to be a young boy living under the Nazis and became very aware of the evil that governments could do and was determined to try to prevent a recurrence of that kind of evil. Now, you know, I don't compare other situations to the Nazis. You know, they were pretty sui generis. But Yuval Abraham, you know, what he's talking about today is that there really, you know, traditionally have been three options on the table for resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. One is recognition that the settlement project is so advanced that a Palestinian state is impossible, and therefore you have a so-called one-state reality between the Mediterranean Sea and the Jordan River, and there everybody should have equal rights. But of course, the Israeli government doesn't want that because they're roughly the same number of Jews and Arabs, and they would lose their Jewish majority.
And if anyone talks about from the river to the sea, they're accused of anti-Semitism.
Yeah, although that's silly because it depends what you add to that. If you say, you know, from the river to the sea, there should be no Israel, then fine, that's anti-Semitism. If you say from the river to the sea, there should be equal rights for everybody or two states, you know, living side by side, that's perfectly fine. So it's silly to say river to the sea is a problem. It depends what you add on to it. But, you know, the second option, which is what the Israeli government wants, is to have the endless occupation, the status quo. But that is now broadly recognized as apartheid and unsustainable. So the third option, which I think is the best option, is from the river to the sea to have two states, Israel and Palestine, living side by side. But Netanyahu says, you know, over my dead body. The fourth option that was always sitting on the side, was never really considered legitimate, but Trump just tried to legitimize, was to solve the Palestinian problem by getting rid of the Palestinians. Start with Gaza, get rid of 2 million there, and then what no other land shows is the beginning of ethnic cleansing in the occupied West Bank as well. Now, this would be a blatant war crime. It is utterly unacceptable. Fortunately, the Arab states have said, no way, we are not going to be complicit in another Nakba. So I'm hopeful that that's off the table. And again, if you come back to Trump, the master negotiator, if he wants his big regional deal, if he wants the Saudis to normalize relations with the Israelis, he's got to push Netanyahu to accept a Palestinian state. We've seen he can twist Netanyahu's arm. That's how we got the current temporary ceasefire. He's got to twist that arm harder to get acceptance of what I think is really the only viable long-term solution.
And certainly there are those who feel the way you do. A two-state solution is the only viable one. There are those who feel only a one-state solution would be viable and are not anti-Semitic.
Hmm. Yeah. No, I mean, to say, you know, a one-state solution because the Israeli settlement project has made it really hard to have a Palestinian state. But within that one state, we don't want apartheid. We want equal rights. That's just justice. You know, that's not anti-Semitism. But, you know, I still think finding some way to have the two states would be better. But I could live with the one state as long as it's one state with equal rights, not one state with apartheid for the occupied territories.
So let's talk about the crackdown in the United States and what you see, even going back to your family. I mean, you're now a professor at Princeton. The thousands of students who are being expelled or suspended, they're going through court trials now around the country, professors being fired. And then you look at what's happening in Germany, amazingly, when people criticize Israel. I mean, Jewish Holocaust survivors criticizing Israel are told they cannot speak, they cannot address student assemblies, for example.
Yeah. Now, in Germany, they have this concept called the Staatsraison, which really means, you know, the reason of the state. And understandably, to make amends for the Holocaust, Germany feels they have to do something. But they've interpreted that to mean just defend the Israeli government regardless of what it does, which I think is a huge mistake. What I've written about actually in the German press is that they should take from the Holocaust the importance of upholding rights that would prevent atrocities from like this from ever happening again. But you can't uphold rights and have a Palestinian exception. Because then, you know, next there'll be a Jewish exception, and then there'll be exception for other people. And so the only way to do it is to uphold rights for everybody. That's not the German government's approach. They just think they're going to defend Netanyahu and the far-right extremists in the Israeli government, regardless of what they do. I think that's a misunderstanding of the proper lessons of the Holocaust.
And I think that's clear from your book. The overall message, never again means never again for anyone, anywhere.